We're going to talk about families today. The way I want to start is by talking about what you may think is just an exercise of your imagination, but it's really not. You know more about it than you think you do. Let's talk about healthy families, shall we? Now, the first thing that I need to say as we talk about healthy families is that we are not talking about perfect families. You know where perfect families live? Yeah, on TV, little boxes about this big. They're real little people, and all their problems get solved in 12 minutes, and then they sleep in 2 minutes, and they have another problem. You know, I mean, that's perfect families. We even do perfect blended families. Who's that on TV? The Brady Bunch. They even did step family issues perfectly, didn't they? We do single-parent families on TV perfectly. You remember a couple examples of those?
Courtship of Betty's Father.
Yeah, Courtship. I'd forgotten about that one, Courtship of Betty's Father. What else?
The Partridge Family.
The Partridge Family. Yeah, I think it was. Or it was a blended family. I'm not sure which. Eighth Enough. Remember, he was single for a while, and then he got married. Now, I don't know if I'm dating myself. My Father Knows Best. My Three Sons. Can't you imagine that life is that perfectly as a single parent? So I don't think so. But what we're talking about is healthy families. Now, as you're aware, psychology began by looking at the work of, or the lives of individuals whose lives were not working so successfully. We talk about Freud in some ways as the father of psychotherapy, and Freud worked with a handful of clients in his entire life, fewer than we work with in 1 year. He built all of his theory about how persons function and how personalities are developed and how relationships develop out of that handful of clients. So there is a lot of merit to a lot of Freud's work, but it's skewed because he didn't study any people whose lives were working. Similarly with families, we didn't start studying healthy families until the early 70s. We started studying families by looking at families whose lives were not working. Some of the best research in family therapy that I know about was done in Dallas at Southwest Family Institute and Timberlawn Psychiatric Institute. And they studied a couple of hundred families, and they defined these families as healthy by the fact that all the families had at least one adolescent, and nobody in the family was in therapy at the time. Now, that's a kind of an arbitrary definition. First thing it tells me is you don't know for sure how healthy your family is until you've tried being a parent to a teenager, right? But adolescence brings its own set of opportunities. Secondly, somebody in the family might should have been in therapy and just wasn't, or had been in therapy and was no longer in therapy. So I understand that that's kind of an arbitrary definition. But on the other hand, think about how you would define a healthy family. I think it would have something to do with the ability to turn out kids who function healthy as adults. But that's kind of what family is about, being able to pass on to the next generation the ability to cope well with life, to do life successfully. So these were healthy families in that sense, and they compared them then to a couple of hundred families, all of whom were in family therapy for one reason or another. And they analyzed all the differences and similarities down, and I want to share with you some of the factors that they identified that distinguished between the healthy and the unhealthy families. The first one, healthy families show some capacity for conflict resolution. Now, already you can see that we're not talking about perfect families. Because perfect families don't have conflict, do they? See, healthy families, number one, do have conflict. The family who comes in and says, "We never fight," all that tells me is how they do their conflict. It doesn't tell me they don't have any conflict. Healthy families do have conflict. But number two, they do get some resolution to conflict. See, a lot of times, there are families who never acknowledge their conflict, and so it's always under the surface. Always just under the surface. Other families are always in an uproar. There's always conflict going on, out in the open, wide open. Neither style is real healthy. that somewhere in between is the family who can acknowledge conflict and work toward resolution of that conflict. There are a lot of different ways of talking about conflict resolution. Let me give you a real simple model of conflict resolution. Here's one. Some conflicts can be resolved using a win-lose model. A win-lose conflict resolution. Happens every Sunday afternoon, doesn't it? What do we call it?
Football.
Football. Exactly. Everybody hates a tie game. I'd almost rather my team lose than have a tie, because a tie is kind of like, it's not over yet. We always want a winner. Now, why doesn't that work in families?
Somebody has to lose.
It's not going to be me. And I'm going to keep the conflict alive as long as there's a possibility that I might come out on the winning end. And so rarely does this work in families as a way to resolve conflict. The way that we usually then go to is compromise, where I get some of what I want and you get some of what you want, but neither of us really gets everything that we want. And with a lot of compromise, there's an aftertaste, like a continuing sense of dissatisfaction. Sometimes that's the best you're going to get. Sometimes the conflict is such that compromise is the only workable solution or resolution. However, the third kind of conflict resolution that I want to remind you of is a win-win model of conflict resolution. What do I mean by that? Both parties come out on the winning end. I don't know if that seems unrealistic to you or unimaginable. Let me tell you a little story about a mom, two daughters, fighting over an orange, the only orange they had left in the house at that time. Fighting over the orange, the logical solution is to apply the Solomon technique, right? What is that? Cut it in half. You remember how Solomon said, sure, two moms fighting over a baby, I'll just cut the baby in half and give you each half a baby. Now, it worked in that situation, didn't it? Because the true mom said, no way, you take her. I wouldn't do that to my child. So Solomon knew who was the real mom. Now, so this mom with the two daughters fighting over the orange, she thought, I know about Solomon. I'll just apply the Solomon technique. She cut that orange in half and gave each girl half an orange, and they were both still fussing and unsatisfied. She went back and asked them what was going on. Turns out one daughter only wanted the rind of the orange to make a pie with, and the other daughter just wanted the pulp of the orange to eat. How else could mom have solved that conflict? She could have asked them and then skinned that orange, right? See, there's two ways to skin this cat. She could have solved the conflict with a win-win result if she had only asked and listened. Now, I want to offer you that oftentimes you settle for compromise when you could get win-win if you'd listen longer. Listen for what each party really wants and see if you can work toward then this win-win model. Won't always happen. Sometimes you'll end up working a compromise, but more often than not, you will be able to develop a win-win solution. Yeah, I believe so. I believe more often than not that if we will listen long, we can both get what we need out of a situation. Next family characteristic of these healthy families is that they showed healthy communication. Kind of has something to do with why we spend so much time during Family Week on communication, doesn't it? We want to help you learn how to communicate in effective ways so that your family becomes healthier. And again, like conflict resolution, there are many different ways to talk about communication, and I want to give you just two or three different characteristics of healthy communication. The first one is healthy communication is two-way. It's reciprocal. Delivering or receiving a sermon is not communication. I don't need a lecture, I need a communication. Have you ever heard that? That's because the communication wasn't two-way. Two-way communication means that both parties get the opportunity to share and to listen. So we sit you down in the middle of a family week and we say, here's some guidelines for sharing. and here are some guidelines for listening. And the listening end of the communication should take as much energy as the sharing end of the communication. If you are as actively involved in the communication on the listening end, you'll be as tired as you are if you're on the sharing end, because it takes as much energy. Healthy communication is two-way. Healthy communication is also direct. What do I mean? What does that mean? Direct communication. Yeah? Specifically to the person that I'm interested in talking to. Right, not through a third party. Now, you know, therapists always find fancy labels for everything. We call this triangulation as a form of communication when we send it through a third party. You remember what the Bible called it a couple thousand years ago? Gossip. I mean, you know, I think it's about the same thing. Now, why do we use this kind of communication so often? We're afraid. We want to avoid conflict. When you're sitting there in the middle of the circle and it's just you and her, how high is the anxiety level? Extremely high, isn't it? You've been that way at home, nose to nose with somebody that you need to say something to, and it is so tense that it's easier just to send it through a third party. So it gets as blatant sometimes as like, well, you tell her that if she wants to talk to me, she can come find me. You know, or you tell her that I told her that I said I'm not going to be the one to say I'm sorry first this time. You know, I mean, sometimes it's real blatant. Other times it's much more subtle than that. My favorite is this. You go to someone and you say, now, I want to tell you a secret, and you've got to promise not to tell Daddy. Now, what's she going to do? Absolutely, every time. See, it works. And it's not nearly as anxiety-provoking. However, it's not nearly as effective at resolving the problem, at addressing the issue that the communication was about in the first place. So direct communication, yes, it's more anxiety-provoking, but it's much more effective. It'll get the job done. So you have to learn to be able to tolerate that anxiety. We don't use a lot of anti-anxiety medicine here. We use some, because if a person's anxiety gets so high that they can't even think, then they're not going to be able to do the work of therapy. But we try to teach them other ways to learn to lower their anxiety and tolerate their anxiety. If you can't tolerate anxiety, you probably won't develop a direct communication style. You'll keep using indirect styles of communication. So, two-way, direct, and then thirdly, healthy communication is congruent. A congruent triangle is a triangle that's equal on all sides. All three sides are the same length. Similarly, congruent communication is a way of talking about the fact that the message sent on every level is the same message. Now, what are the levels of communication we talk about a lot of times? You know what I'm talking about? Typically, we talk about verbal and nonverbal forms of communication. And we play body language games at parties even to talk about nonverbal communication. You know, sure, I'm listening. See, that's an incongruent message. That's an incongruent communication. My words say one thing, but my body says something else. Now, actually, there are three levels of communication. Verbal are the words. Nonverbal are our body language signals. And then in between is a level we call paraverbal. That's the expression with which we say the words. The tone of voice, the intonation, and the inflection. Those are called paraverbal messages of communication. We talked yesterday about how a two-year-old can say no in many different tones of voice and mean different things. Now, you've tried that too. You've said no to a guy like this. No. Did he believe you? Same word, but he didn't believe you, did you? Or you've said no, and he still didn't believe you. Or you've said no, and he may have believed you. All with a different tone of voice, because that paraverbal level of communication is really, really important. So you got verbal, paraverbal, and nonverbal. Now, when that message or communication is incongruent, when different signals are sent on various levels of message, two things occur. When you say to your child, don't you do that again or I'm going to beat you black and blue, and you've never raised a hand to them, what are they going to believe? They're going to believe the unspoken message, aren't they? The unspoken message that says, but I really don't mean it because I can't enforce my discipline. Or when you a story about a mom who sent her son at college a couple of new shirts, and she went to visit him, so he wore one of the new shirts for her weekend visit, and she got there and she said, "My, that shirt looks good on you. How come you didn't wear the other one?" Now, how do you please a mom like that? Yeah. See, the mixed message says, on the one hand, I approve of you, and on the other hand, I don't approve of you. We do that in subtle ways and sometimes obvious ways like that. The result is, number one, at least that the child is confused, if not crazy. That kind of communication leaves a person wondering, questioning, what can I do to get her to approve of me? How can I get her how can I make her know I want her to love me? And so the child keeps on keeping on trying to get that approval that he or she is so hungry for, because the message was so confusing that the child doesn't really know where she stands. And secondly, when a child hears you say, now, I want you to be careful and don't get into too much danger, and you're taking stupid risks, which message does the child believe? What you say or what you do? What you do. See, that's another kind of incongruent communication. Now, children, understand that you can't run from your problems by using alcohol. By the way, hon, fix me a double tonight. What's the problem with that? See, the problem is the message has been confusing, and children are going to believe the message they see over the message they hear. That's why they end up doing what we told them not to do a lot of times, because they've seen us do it as well. So healthy communication's got to have these three characteristics. Got to be two-way, direct, and congruent. Questions? How are we doing so far? Third one, third characteristic of healthy families is this quality called cohesion. Cohesion is a way of talking about the glue that holds us together. And healthy families have enough glue holding them together so that they don't just fall apart as a family, but they don't have so much glue that you can't get out of that family if you want to, if it's appropriate. Now, what I'm talking about is the fact that cohesion is like on a continuum. At one end of the continuum, we have some families who have so little glue holding them together, so little cohesion, that we call them disengaged. They are disengaged families. And on the other end, we have families who have so much cohesion that we call them enmeshed. To a certain extent, these degrees of cohesion are just a reflection of family style. Some families are closer than other families, and younger families are closer than older families. When my kids were all little, we didn't let them go around the corner without one of us. We didn't let them go play with their friends around the block without one of us accompanying them. They didn't have much leash at all, if you will. That we had a lot of closeness or a lot of cohesion in our family, so we would have been up here somewhere. By the time they were in grade school, we'd let them ride around the corner on their bikes and they'd play more. We were getting a little less cohesion. They'd spend the night with friends. We live in a small town now. They ride downtown. It's a mile away from our house, and they can go to the card shop by themselves, and they have a lot more leash, even though they're still only 13, 11, and 9, because the conditions are different, because our family's older. And so the degree of cohesion will change as the family grows and develops. So it's a matter of style to one extent or another. But what happens if you still have the same degree of cohesion when you have adolescent kids that you had when they were elementary age? Is it going to work? No. They go crazy. That's right. Mom, 8 o'clock's too early for bedtime. I'm 15 years old. It's like, give me some rope. Give me some space. Give me some slack. So then as the family stage moves on, if the family develops, but the degree of cohesion does not change, then it becomes not just a matter of style, but a matter of how well the family is going to function. See, the same set of rules won't work for an older family that worked for a younger family. It might have been just the opposite in your family. When you were real little, your parents might have parented you like they would parent an adolescent. A six-year-old making up his mind about when he's going to go to bed. It's like, yeah, whenever you want to, kid. Easy come, easy go. The result is the family has so little cohesion that the kids don't have any stability, no groundedness, no roots. Okay? So the degree of cohesion has got to be appropriate to the stage of the family. Now, also with respect to style, different style families have different strengths and weaknesses. For instance, kids who come from disengaged families oftentimes develop independence much younger. Kids from disengaged families get a paper route when they're 9 years old, and they start working in a restaurant when they're 15, and they go off to college, and they go clear across country or out of the country. They move on with their lives. The disengaged family looks at the world out there as an adventure. Let's go for it. You know, life is out there. Home is just kind of a crash pad. It's a place to stop in between adventures out there in the world. For the enmeshed family, safety is where? In the world or at home? At home. Messages like blood is thicker than water. That's a statement of an enmeshed kind of family, that regardless of what happens to you in life, you'll always have family. Well, sometimes people adopt emotional families. In my family, for instance, all of us children are adults now, and our emotional relationships are much closer in our current sphere relationships than we are with our siblings. We still see each other a couple times a year, most of us, and have pretty clear relationships, but in terms of our heart bondedness, we've connected with people in our present worlds more. The mom who says, every time you got a problem, dear, you've got to run home to me, is going to keep her daughter too young, because that's not an adult message. This family gives more support for the development of independence and self-sufficiency. This family gives more support for closeness, but not for boundaries. This family gives a lot of support for boundaries, but not for closeness. These families teach kids to not need nobody for nothing a lot of times. Now, in terms of health, the ideal place is probably somewhere right in here. A little bit more cohesion than less, but not so much that it becomes suffocating or stifling. This is a kind of a hard concept to get a handle on. But questions? Things I need to clarify or say a little more about? Doing all right? Okay. A couple more factors of healthy families. The next one that I want to mention is expressiveness. Expressiveness. Now, when we talk about communication, we're usually talking about the transfer of ideas or thoughts or belief. When we talk about expressiveness, what we're talking about is the transfer of emotions. Emotions are they're kind of tricky. There are some things that emotions are lousy for, like decision-making. If you make your decisions based on emotions, you're going to change your mind about your decision every time your emotions go up and down. Judgments, goal planning, all of those things, when based on emotions only, are going to be real shaky. So emotions can't accomplish everything in your life. But there is one thing in life that you cannot be successful at unless you can successfully do emotions. And that's relationships. See, emotions are the stuff of relationships. They're the medium in which relationships thrive, in which they live. Like water is the medium that a fish lives in, emotions are the medium that relationships live in. If you can't successfully do emotions, then you're not going to be able to successfully do relationships. That's not the only factor involved in relationships, but it's the medium for relationships. Now, when we talk about healthy families being able to do this thing called expressiveness, there are a couple of different directions that we're talking about. The first one is that healthy families show a range of emotions. That it's not just one emotion in this family that gets expressed, but that a full range of emotions get expressed. On your truth and love lists, we attached a list of feeling words to help you learn to express a range of emotions. Sometimes you might be mildly irritated, and sometimes you might be royally ticked. But if you can't do that range of feelings or that intensity of feelings, then the expressiveness in the family is going to be constricted. Another thing about range. Sometimes in families, one person in the family has permission to do X feeling, anger. Who oftentimes gets permission to do anger in the family? Dad. Dad can do anger, but Mama can't. And the kids? No way, Jose. Who can do love? So what happens when Dad wants to do that warm, mushy stuff with his kids? He feels like it's out of place. He doesn't know how to do it. Maybe it's even wrong. That's girl stuff. I won't do that. Or what happens when Mom needs to make the decisions in the family? Dad's away on vacation, and this thing needs to be dealt with now. Oh, but Moms don't do that. We have to wait for Daddy. You see how the family is going to be crippled? See, everybody in the family has got to have permission and support and encouragement to do a wide range of feelings, whether it's anger, whether it's affection, whether it's excitement. Some families are so stable, they're boring. You know, it's like you need a little bit of excitement. Now, the other direction of feelings or emotions that we're talking about is intensity. Like we talked about mildly irritated versus royally ticked. See, if the only way your family knows how to do anger is in a rage, what happens when you're just a little annoyed? You got to do a rage again. Or what happens if your family doesn't really like to get too excited about anything? We're too cool. And so when something is absolutely, passionately, fabulous, but you can't express that because you got to be cool. See, then the family's functioning is going to be impaired. Healthy families can express a range and an intensity of feelings across family members. Finally, let me talk to you about one other factor of healthy families, and that is directive leadership. Directive leadership. A couple of things implied in this. The first one is that healthy families have a direction. There's a sense that the family's going somewhere, that we're not just marking time, like you wake up one morning and you think, so what's going to be different about today than yesterday? See, that healthy families have got a focus and a purpose and a direction and a meaning for their lives. Sometimes that's through goal setting. It may be we want to go to San Diego for vacation this summer, so everybody, we got to cut corners. We can't eat out as often. We got to save up, okay? And that goal gives us a direction to move as a family together. Or, listen, we need to develop some activities that we enjoy doing as a family. How about let's go hike Vulture Peak this weekend and see if we enjoy it? Maybe hiking is something all of us could get into. See, again, it's a way that the family has a direction to go as a unit. Secondly, that direction comes from the leadership in the home. You families of eating disordered women, who's been setting the direction in your home? Does it oftentimes come from the one with the eating disorder? Who decides which restaurants you go to? We can't go there, they don't have a salad bar. Yeah. What if you want chicken fried steak and they don't have a salad bar there? Go get some chicken fried steak. Let her choose some of the restaurants. Let her choose some of the meals, as you heard last night with Deborah, but don't let her choose them all. You need to eat too, don't you? And there are not any good foods or bad foods, so let's expose her to some risk, and let's support her by letting her have some safe foods and some safe restaurants as well. The leadership in the home oftentimes comes from the angriest person in the family. It may be one of your kids is always in anger, always in a rage, and so the whole family kind of tiptoes around him. We don't want to upset him because you know what happens if he gets upset. And you end up letting that person direct or set the direction for the home. The leadership in the family, the direction in the family must come from the leadership, and it needs to come from the top down. We talk about it, the psychobabble for it is generational hierarchies. It gets messed up in a couple different ways. Let's say we've got a dad and a mom, and then we got three kids. Sometimes dad may be absent, either emotionally or physically. It may be a single family. Or he may be so involved in work that he's rarely in the family. That he's more in work than he is in the family. One of the common things that occurs is one of these kids, oftentimes the oldest, gets drafted into the parent system. It's kind of like they take over the absent functioning. We call them a parentified child because on the inside, they're still a child, even though on the outside, they're functioning and acting and behaving as a parent. Now, there are all sorts of problems like with that. What if dad wants to come back in the family? Excuse me, now we've got three parents. There is going to be conflict. Or what if dad is divorced but wants to continue to be involved in the kid's life as a parent? How is this parentified child going to cope with that? Going to make him mad, going to make her mad. Now, sometimes the absent parent is absent because of death. When a parent dies, don't the kids feel ripped off? Oftentimes they do. It's like they did that to me on purpose. And as irrational as that is, it's easy to understand that they feel betrayed. However, in situations like that, when the parent dies and one of the children starts to function as a parent to help out, that's not necessarily dysfunctional. Some of you grew up in the Depression. One of your parents was not around. You went to work when you were 13, maybe. 10. Making a living. Had to be a parent to the rest of the kids, as it were. Somebody was talking about yesterday being one of 14 kids. You would come from that big of a family, some of those kids are going to function like parents, I guarantee you. It's not necessarily dysfunctional if the cost is acknowledged. If the cost to the child who has to grow up too fast is acknowledged, then it won't necessarily be dysfunctional. If the cost isn't even noticed, then that child learns that her feelings are not worth noticing. And so she'll learn more and more to just stuff her feelings and perform her role. That's one way it gets messed up. Another way it gets messed up sometimes is there may be two parents in this family, but one of them acts like a kid. When my wife was bulimic for 12 years, a lot of times I felt like I had four kids. You know, it was me and the kids. That I ended up having to parent Karen as much as I did the other children from time to time. Now, in some ways that may have kept her alive. And in some ways that may have helped our children's development continue as I functioned as a super parent, if you will. But the cost was unavoidable. My children will still walk past Karen and come ask me something. Hey, Dad, I need some milk. Because they're used to thinking about one parent. And I have to say, kids, you got two parents, not just one. Excuse me just a second. I'm going to let Stephen slip out here. So we're still having to retrain our children in thinking about having two functioning parents. If you are a mom and you're the eating disordered woman in your family, you may well have not been functioning as a parent successfully with your children, and your partner may well have been over-functioning. It is going to be a task that you need to face and accomplish to move back into a successful parenting role. That means your partner is going to have to give up treating you like a kid, and you're going to have to quit wanting your partner to treat you like a kid, and you're going to have to require of your children the respect of you as a parent and not let them continue to disrespect you or treat you as just one of the other kids. You can't do that overnight. As soon as you walk out of here and go home, you can't say, okay, now I'm a parent, kids, don't forget it. It's something that's going to have to be earned by your successful functioning as a parent. One other word on the leadership, and then I'll quit. The most successful form of leadership is two parents. Mom and dad being the leadership subset in the family. If there are two parents in the family and only one parent is the leader, it is fraught with problems. If mom is the leader, she's either going to resent that he won't wear the pants in the family, or he's going to resent that she won't let him. If dad is the leader and mom is only a follower, she will train her daughters to be only followers, and they will follow a man into dysfunction. They will follow a boss into dysfunction. They will follow a church leader into dysfunction. That mom who is only a follower is passive and dependent on a dad who is the only leader will teach her daughters to not have a mind of her own. And so the most successful form of leadership in the family is a two-parent leadership model. Now here's what you need to do. Put these on a scale like of 0 to 6 and give yourself a score, because the family you grew up in or the family you currently live in, either one or both, just kind of give your family a score. See what you think. There are some of these that you probably did better in than others. There are some of them that you may have never done. I don't know. There may have been some that just did not exist in the family you grew up in. But a couple of things. The first one is, you really can have some strengths, even if you have some weaknesses in the family. That's understandable. Now, secondly, let's talk about what happens when your scores are real low, when the family has not been successful in its functioning. When these things start breaking down, when they're not functioning well, what starts going on inside the individuals in the family? What do you feel?
Failure.
Pain and hurt. Resentment. Anxiety. Conflict. Maybe even depression. All sort of things start coming up. Now, our typical response when our anxiety level goes up and our pain level goes up is to try to grab for some control to get it fixed, right? We talked about how eating disordered women do that oftentimes with food. If I could just get on a diet, maybe my life would start going right. We all have that kind of response when our inner pain level starts going up. Mine is, I get more compulsive. It's going to be done this order, this way, my schedule, when I want it, the way I want it. You walk in, it's been a lousy day at the office, and the living room's a mess, and dinner's late, and the kids are squabbling, and the natural response is, would everybody just do what you're supposed to do? If you'd pick up the living room when I come home, then I wouldn't be so hassled when I walk in from the office, and if dinner would be on time, and if everybody would just sit in their right chair. We just want things to get under control so that we don't feel so anxious inside, right? If everybody would just do what they're supposed to do and say what they're supposed to say and be where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there, then I wouldn't feel so bad. And neither would you. There's some truth to that. There is one place in life in which human beings actually do that. There is a place in life, an experience in life, in which humans actually say what they're supposed to say, when they're supposed to say it, and they be where they're supposed to be, and they do what they're supposed to do. You know what it's called? The theater. It's a play, right? See, in a play, the actors are handed a script. They act out a role, and it tells them exactly where they're supposed to be, when they're supposed to be there, what they're supposed to say, how they're supposed to say it, and as long as everybody acts out their role according to their script, then the play is a hit. See, it really does work, doesn't it? Why doesn't it work in families? Because there's no play?
No script.
No script. That's right. Oftentimes the script is unspoken. I have a script for you, but you don't know it. How does that leave you feeling? I know what I think you're supposed to say or do or feel, but you don't. You going to be able to successfully satisfy me? No way. That's one of the big reasons why roles don't work in families. Now again, let me define this. Family roles are the preset patterns of performance that we adopt in order to lower our anxiety level. Does that make sense? Family roles are the sets of behaviors that we just put on in order to lower our anxiety level. If everybody will just do what they're supposed to do, then we won't feel so bad. So it's a real natural occurrence. In fact, we need family roles. We need roles in life. They give us some clues about how we're supposed to operate, how we're supposed to perform or get along. For instance, when I come to work and I act as a father instead of a clinical director to 25 residents, how's that going to work? Do you need another daddy? You got one, don't you? You don't need fathering from me. You need me to adopt the role of clinical director to make sure that your treatment goes the way it goes, that you get what you need to deal with your heart woundedness, to deal with your behavior, to deal with your emotional issues, your spiritual issues. If I were as involved with you as a father, would I be able to be objective enough to guide your treatment? Now, what happens when I go home and act as a clinical director? I can tell you what happened. When I was first learning to do therapy, one of my professors, I promise, I know he told us to practice on every person we met. I assumed he meant my wife also. So Karen was in a uproar about something, and what she wanted was an argument or discussion or something. She wanted a partner in this thing, and I kept my therapy role on. And I said, now what I hear you saying is, and about the third time I said that, she said, here it is, Don, and told me where to put it. She didn't need a therapist. She needed a partner. She needed a husband. My kids need a daddy. See, roles tell us what and how we're supposed to be in life. So they're not necessarily dysfunctional. They become dysfunctional. Two things. They become dysfunctional, number one, when they are so rigid that when I want to change, I can't. That's the first one. Roles become dysfunctional when they are so rigid that when I want to change, I can't. And secondly, roles become dysfunctional when there is such a discrepancy between what I look like on the outside and who I am on the inside that my inside gets lost. Let's talk about the dysfunctional family roles that developed from our studies of families of alcoholics. You know the family roles I'm talking about? We talk about the victim, the person with the addiction. And then we talk about the victim's partner. You know what? Do you remember what the original term was for the partner of the alcoholic? Even before enabler, there was another one before that. It was co-alcoholic. That was the original term. That seems to imply that she's addicted to alcohol also, and so we scrapped that term. The next one was enabler, that somehow it's almost like she participates in keeping him hooked on booze. Now, I've only had that real explicitly a few times. I had one one family one time tell us, actually, you know, when he's sober, he's a lot harder to live with than when he's drinking. We'd just rather, you know, just have a little bit. It mellows him out. You see how they literally enabled his alcoholism? Usually it's a lot more subtle than that. Enabling him, it seems to imply that there's some conscious intent. And usually the patterns of enabling are not conscious, not intentional. And so the latest term then that we use for the partner is codependent. And you've been there. You've been there with the addict, bulimic, or anorexic in your family. You've been so involved in her problem, trying to get her well, that you were as involved as she was in staying sick. Your life revolved around her addiction as much as her life revolved around her addiction. And then we talked about the kids in the family. What are those roles? Help me out here. What are those terms we talk about a lot? Remember them? Lost child, one of them. Heroes, another one. Scapegoat, one more. Clown or mascot. Now, I wrote them in this order purposefully. Oftentimes, these are the orders of development in a family, of these family roles. Now, I'm going to give you a handout before we close that more thoroughly describes these, but let me run through the development of these family roles for you. When there's an addict in the family, there's going to be conflict. There's going to be that inner anxiety. He doesn't want to quit, and she wants him to quit, and he says, I can quit anytime I want to, and she says, well, then do it, and he says, I don't want to. So they keep going around and around that mulberry bush. And that conflict is inevitable. Oftentimes, the firstborn child is conceived in the hope that that child will save us, will save our marriage, will give us something to focus on together so we stop fighting. The child is born into a position then of having to perform to keep mom and dad together. How's that for a job? I mean, that's a task for a therapist, not for a firstborn child. But you know what? Sometimes firstborn children are really good at it. They become heroes. They become absolute achievers. They're good at everything. They can do sports and they can do studies and they can do relationships. And aren't you proud of them, mom and dad? And for a while, it really does work in lowering the conflict between mom and dad, because they've got all of their energy wrapped up in this child who brings them honor and a sense of worth because of, we couldn't be that bad. Look what we produced. Second kid comes along, and there's no way that child is going to compete with the first one for the limelight. This child has got all of the positive attention wrapped up. So the second kid comes along and says, no way, I'm going to try that. I'll get it some other way. And becomes the scapegoat. Becomes the one who gets in trouble all the time. Becomes the rebel. The scapegoat gets dumped on in the family a lot of times. And sometimes it seems kind of legitimate because they're always in trouble. They act out. They're angry. They're difficult to live with. They're underachieving. They don't perform. They're almost like an opposite of that first one, you know? Third kid comes along, and there's just not a lot of emotion, energy, time left around. The third child hears things like this. Gee, I don't think we're going to be able to be there. I mean, Monday night we're at the awards ceremony, and Tuesday night I know we'll be at the jail bailing him out, so I just don't think there's enough time for you. The third child, the parents will often say, thank God she didn't take as much attention as these first two did. I don't know what we would have done if she had needed as much as they did. And you know what? She did need as much as they did. But she didn't get it. She became invisible. She learned to take care of herself. She learned to entertain herself. She became much more seemingly self-sufficient. The fourth child comes along, and as you can tell, this is a pretty intense family, and we just need a little comic relief. And the last kid is oftentimes born with a sense of humor. I mean, she comes out cracking jokes, and she can keep the family in stitches. My youngest is like that. My family follows this pretty closely. Jessica, in many ways, is the hero. She really can do nearly anything well. We already call her a junior therapist. She walks in and analyzes you guys and hits it pretty much on the head sometimes. She's really sharp. She also analyzes me and Karen and hits it on the head sometimes pretty successfully. She is lots to be proud of. Don Michael is an underachiever. He's more intelligent than Jess, but doesn't make nearly the grades that she does. He gets angrier a lot. He's moody. He's temperamental. He's harder to discipline. Jessica, you can correct her with a glance. Don Michael needs a paddle. Don Michael, you have to ground him. He's 11. I've got him on an eligibility system for sports already just to get him to do his homework so he can play soccer. Christopher, our youngest, oscillates between these two. When Chris was little, he was a 3 and he broke his right leg twice. For 4 out of 5 months, he was in a cast. Long story. He, during that time, though, developed many skills of self-sufficiency. He played for hours by himself. It was harder on Karen and me than it was on him. He did terrific through all of that. Out of that, he developed a quietness and an observant attitude. He can watch and know what's going on in the family. He's the one I mentioned the other day, said, "Boy, I hope Mom's in a better mood when we get home from church, because the house won't be a happy place if she's not." You know, he can read the tone of the family. And the kid was born with an abstract sense of humor. I mean, he sees things in a funny way, and he says things in a funny way. He is a delight to be with. Now, here's the difference between roles and dysfunctional family roles. What happens if Don Michael, the scapegoat, wants to perform? What if the bad seed in your family actually wants to succeed? What if the black sheep wants to turn white? She succeeds in something and you go, "Wow, that's just not like her." See, the family continues to keep her locked into the scapegoat role. Wait a minute. Now, I don't think you can do that because, you know, you've never been good at school. Or, now you know your temper's going to get you in trouble. You know what? If you tell a kid that, it will. It'll happen. Our predictions come true oftentimes. What if the hero wants to be angry? Does the hero have permission in your family to be angry? See, the hero's got to stay up there on that statue because you got to make us proud. Have you ever tried making love to a statue? See, statues you cannot be intimate with. And statues get real lonely. The hero must be allowed to come down off her pedestal, or she won't be rounded and whole as an individual. What if the lost child really does want that attention and cannot break out of her role to get it? What if the mascot really has got something serious to say? Will anybody listen to him? "Oh, Chris, you're just joking. Oh, yeah, that's right, I was." No, I wasn't. See, the tragedy of these family roles are those two factors that I mentioned to you earlier. When they become so rigid that when I need or want something different, I don't have permission to do it or get it. And secondly, when all I can do in my family is fulfill my role, perform my role, and my heart is different. My outside becomes a mask, and my inside becomes lost. Now, in the handout I will give you on these family roles, the outside of each person in this family looks very different. Every person looks very different on the outside, but on the inside, they all have anger, resentment, insecurity, low self-esteem, guilt, shame. They're all filled with the same thing because they're all human. Human needs are the same, regardless of family position or family role. And so we must allow these roles to be flexible so that our inside, our inner needs can be met, can be acknowledged and met. Now, I'm going to give you one other way of looking at families before we quit. Pat Fallon is a psychologist in Seattle who's done a lot of research with eating disorder families, and She has described three different family patterns that oftentimes are related to people with eating disorders. The first one's called the perfect family, where we already know, you have to put that in quotes, don't you? They're perfect in that they are committed to maintaining the illusion of perfection. The perfect family sends their daughter off at the perfect age to the perfect boarding school, to the perfect university, to marry the perfect man with the perfect career, and maintain the perfect degree of extended family involvement. But woe be the person in that family who admits, I'm human, not perfect. And remember how that feeds an eating disorder? When we talked about the attempted solutions yesterday, I'll keep looking perfect so I have a place to belong. But my eating disorder is a way of saying, I am not perfect. The second family structure that she identifies, that Dr. Fallon identifies, is called the overprotective family. The overprotective family doesn't really care what the neighbors think. There's no way I'm going to let my daughter leave home. She'll be 35 before she starts dating. They are so concerned for safety that they don't even follow accepted cultural guidelines. They just protect her. What's that going to do to her? It's going to keep her little. She's not going to grow up. She's not going to develop a life and identity of her own. And her eating disorder may become her identity. And then the third family structure that Dr. Fallon identified is called the chaotic family. And remember yesterday when we were talking about an eating disorder as an addiction, we identified the fact that oftentimes a person's world may be so chaotic that she'll settle for the routine of an addiction, of an eating disorder. And so that's how that family structure is related. Now, when you get your handouts, the first page is this cartoon of family roles, and then the next three pages are descriptions of those family types that I mentioned, perfect, overprotective, and chaotic. Here's what I'd invite you to do. Go through these and underline or highlight the sentences from each of the three that you feel like describe your family. And then write them all together into one composite description and see what it sounds like. See how it matches up with what the eating disordered individual in your family perceives. What are the comparisons? What are the similarities and what are the differences? Let me say one other word about families. When these roles become dysfunctional, rigid, and facade-like, the conflict and anxiety inside just keeps on going up. That is when we start looking for an anesthesia for that pain. That is when we start looking for something to numb the pain out. Remember what the most successful anesthesias are? Addictions. One of you dads mentioned Sunday night, we are a family of eating disorders. See? Lots of people in this family have used an eating disorder, perhaps, to deal with that inner pain that they couldn't get to because of those masks. Yesterday in our family group, we talked about the relatedness of several different kinds of addictive patterns. That's how kids learn addictions. They see other people in the family using the addiction to make the pain of not knowing how to get to their heart pain go away. If you want to support the eating disordered woman in her recovery, the single most effective thing you can do is get yourself into recovery. What is it you want to grow out of? What is it that you want to grow into? What's the cutting edge of your healing? Acknowledge that to her. Become her partner in recovery, and that will be immensely supportive of her in that recovery process. Thank you for your attention.